We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behaviour. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm. CO2 may make the Earth too warm. It holds in heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap heat.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide.
They all trap
heat. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes. We can do this.
Change the world.
Silence offers us answers
for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does,
affects everybody all over the world.
It's one global ecosystem.
Warm, wet, cold or dry. All start in the sky.
Warm, wet, cold or dry.
Climates all start in the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high. Moving together in lockstep. When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low. Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Silence offers us answers
for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up.
The rise in CO2 comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, bad oxygen
makes CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they form.
We're talking about something that affects the entire Earth. Problems that transcend nations. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers
for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Our program starts off with the really big challenges of the 21st century. There was a time when Americans believed they could do anything, such as flying to the moon and conquering polio. Where are the breakthroughs in the 21st century? What can be done with energy, water, cancer, and climate change? Tom Ashbrook talks with Jason Poynton, David Keith, and Jeffrey Grossman, and then after that, Dan Arley talks with Indra Vizacontas about the honest truth about dishonesty.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our cell phones do things they didn't dream of on Star Trek. Molecular biology is an amazing, underappreciated revolution. But do we still have what it takes for giant breakthroughs on the great challenges of our time, on climate change, fresh water, energy, cancer? Where's our walk on the moon and the right stuff to make it happen? This hour On Point, tackling the really big challenges of the 21st century. You can join the conversation. Have we still got the stuff, the confidence, the ambition, the nerve to do really big things, to solve really big problems? What's holding us back? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. There was a time in the 20th century when Americans basically felt there was nothing they could not do if the country set its mind to it. Let's just throw our minds back to that for a moment. This was September 12th, 1962, the famous passage, John F. Kennedy making a speech to students at Rice University, asserting his goal to be the first nation to land on the moon and lead the efforts in space exploration.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
President John F. Kennedy with a great, big, ambitious, hairy goal, September 12, 1962. And then, less than 7 years later, July 21st, 1969, it happened. Neil Armstrong set foot on the surface of the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
So where's our giant leap, or leaps, the leaps we need? Joining me first in the studio today is Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief of MIT's Technology Review. His November-December Big Solutions issue has been getting a lot of attention. It's headlined, "You Promised Me Mars Colonies, Instead I Got Facebook," and asks why we've stopped solving really big problems and how to make it happen again. We'll talk in this hour with a couple of technologists who are not giving up. Jason Ponton wrote the lead essay. He's with us. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. You were 5 years old when those first steps went on to the moon, those footprints there, I think in Berkeley, California, with your family. And no doubt you shared the sense that we all shared, that anything was possible.
I was absolutely certain by this point there would be colonies on Mars. And yet something seemed to happen. The accelerative thrust of technological evolution has seemed to slow. And in our issue, we wanted to ask why that was, and to look at some of the technologists who haven't given up but still hope to solve big civilizational problems.
Civilizational problems. Let us hang on to that idea, because we've got plenty of them and they need solving. You're not considering this in a vacuum. This is a question, a theme that's getting a lot of attention. I've heard Peter Thiel and others talk about it out of Silicon Valley. People all over the place are saying, what's going on? We're working. Yes, we're getting more cool smartphone apps. Yes, we've got Angry Birds, but where are the big answers? Give us a sense of the conversation around this question.
So it's become a commonplace to ask what happened to the future. In Silicon Valley, it's expressed a little bit more narrowly, a little bit more parochially. They say, what happened to our capacity to invest in big innovative companies? They look at the companies that were founded in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, companies like Intel and Apple and Microsoft, and they look by contrast at what happens now. SuperPoke or Twitter or Facebook, which are large in scale, but don't do the kinds of things that Bill Gates said he wants to do when he founded Microsoft, put a computer on every desktop and every home, or what Steve Jobs said he wanted to do when he founded Apple, to create insanely great machines, the best computers in the world. So all over the world, whether it's in Silicon Valley or inside the U.S. government or in academia here in Boston at MIT and Harvard, people are saying we seem to have lost our confidence, our willingness and our ability to take on problems that excite the imagination and significantly improve human outcomes.
Lord knows, we need that ambition. We need that kind of what you call in the moonshot, saying that their presence on the moon's silent gray surface, you write, was the culmination of a convulsive, collective effort. And it really excited people. I mean, we don't want to lose the sense of what that excitement can be. You quote Nabokov here, cabling the New York Times after this. You know, of course, the great novelist from Switzerland, right? riding, treading the soil of the moon, palpating its pebbles, tasting the panic and splendor of the event, feeling in the pit of one's stomach the separation from Terra, Earth. These form the most romantic sensation an explorer has ever known. We both have really daunting challenges, and we need that sense of even splendor in our ambitions. Is it out there?
So that's the extraordinary thing about the Apollo effort. At its height, it commanded 4% of the U.S. Federal budget.
Gigantic.
Gigantic amount. Mm-hmm. It cost $180 billion in today's dollars to complete. It employed 400,000 people and more than 20,000 companies, government agencies, and other institutions in academia. And the question is, why did we go? And there's a cynical answer, mm-hmm. that we went to demonstrate to the Russians that our engineering was better than their rocketry,
right,
at the height of the Cold War. But your quotation from Nabokov and your quotation from Kennedy show that that wasn't the real reason. At the time, people felt a sense of transcendent wonder in the power of technology to do big things. And then after that, something began to slow. And gradually, we began to lose hope. Since 1972, mm-hmm. which was the last year Apollo went into space, Apollo 17, no one has gone below low Earth orbit. No one has traveled faster than
Let's
Apollo
just say that
10.
Again. We have not gone below low Earth orbit with all of our space mm-hmm. shuttles and everything else. Go on.
We haven't gone faster than Apollo 10, which had sped human beings to 25,000 miles an hour.
Meaning just the sort of raw speed that we mm-hmm. hit then, we haven't matched that. We haven't gone beyond it.
So that metaphor for accelerative thrust has collapsed. In fact, we're going slower since the Concorde stopped flying mm-hmm. A decade ago. Civilian travel has actually become slower. But putting aside Apollo as a metaphor for big things, something more profound has happened. We've stopped solving or trying to solve some of the big problems that we had been absolutely confident that technology would take on.
You're right. Blithe optimism about technology's powers has mm-hmm. evaporated to us. Big problems that people had imagined technology would solve, such as hunger, poverty, malaria, climate change, cancer, diseases of old age, have come to seem intractably hard. Then we thought, there's a huge problem, we'll solve it. Now we look at it and think, maybe not.
President Nixon declared a war on cancer in 1971. And 40 years later, and billions of dollars of investment later, we've only gradually, really in the last 2 or 3 years, begun to make some real progress in the field.
What do you think is the problem? Silicon Valley looks at venture capital and says they're looking for too quick returns. They don't go for the big long-term investment. But you point to other things as well. There was a cultural moment then. Mm. Adults in the 60s, many of them had, you know, been young during World War II. They had seen the vivid example of a nation's entire resources marshaled for war, and they knew that model. They were kind of ready to be marshaled again in a sort of hybrid of private and public huge enterprise. What's slipped away? What's gone?
Yeah, so the answer is that there is no simple explanation mm-hmm. about what happened. Certainly Silicon Valley's explanation is, as I say, parochial. It is sufficient to explain what's wrong with Silicon Valley and what's wrong with venture capital. But I think our failure of confidence is more profound. There are, we think, essentially four reasons mm-hmm. why we've stopped solving big problems. The first is that sometimes we choose not to solve them, and this is a entirely legitimate reason. We could go to Mars right now, Tom, if mm-hmm. we wanted to.
Could do it. There's a NASA plan on the shelf. Hughes.
There, in fact, is a NASA plan sitting inside NASA.
And we meaning not just robots, but
human beings. Could walk yep. on the surface of Mars and mm-hmm. palpate the surface, as Nabokov said, in around 2030. All we'd have to do is start working on a series of quite difficult technological problems around now and give NASA maybe an additional $3 billion a year.
But that one we choose not. It's a choice.
And it's a democratic choice. Mm-hmm. It seems there are more important things to do on mm-hmm. Earth. And I think that's a legitimate reason
sure.
not to do something.
Yeah.
The second reason I think is more profound, and we should get into this more. Sometimes our institutions fail. And by that, I mean to solve really big problems requires the cooperation of all our states, of academia and government and private enterprise acting together under a general willingness to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. And we can talk the specific example of fixing climate change and creating clean energy, but our institutions have failed to tackle that.
I mean, we can't even stay away from the fiscal cliff, let alone fix climate change.
We have profound institutional problems with how our government functions and how it interacts as a policy-making organization with private enterprise.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about accomplishing big, big things again. Scientific, technological breakthroughs 40 years after man last stood on the moon. Why that hasn't been happening so much and what it would take to do it again. Jason Ponton is with us. He's editor-in-chief of MIT's Technology Review. They're taking a very big look at this in their current issue. We're going to hear in just a few minutes from a couple of the scientists doing great stuff, still not giving up whatsoever, but we're looking at why we are not knocking down these challenges one after another. Let's hear a little more of that history. It wasn't always going to the moon. Sometimes it was very much right here on Earth, but the ambition was large. Here's October 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower speaking in Detroit about the need for a vast new highway program, the interstate highway system.
We are pushing ahead with a great road program, a road program that will take this nation out of its antiquated shackles of secondary roads all over this country and give us the types of highways that we need for this great mass of voters.
And within 2 years, it was authorized, and off it went. Now, you may or may not like all those, you know, oil-gobbling cars on the highways, but that changed this country. Now we can't even approve infrastructure fixes. A year later, polio. It was still a big scourge in the United States and around the world in the 1950s. Then Dr. Jonas Salk discovered a vaccine, but it was also American citizens contributing to the March of Dimes and the U.S. government mobilizing industry to manufacture and distribute that vaccine that changed the lives of billions around the world. Here's a 1955 newsreel.
The number two story of the year promised children a new life free of polio. For some, Dr. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine was too late. But for millions of others, this was the answer to a dream. Vaccine. Every available ounce was grabbed up. The government was forced to set up a distribution program so all could have an equal chance at the life-saving drug.
Everybody on board to solve big problems. Mitt Romney talked about this in his acceptance speech at the Republican convention last summer. And it's kind of a mixed message. But we'll hear first he identified pretty much what Jason Ponton is talking about, American attitudes in the middle of the 20th century. Here's Romney in Tampa in August.
I was born in the middle of the century, in the middle of the country, a classic baby boomer. It was a time when Americans were returning from war and eager to work. To be an American was to assume that all things were possible. When President Kennedy challenged Americans to go to the moon, the question wasn't whether we'd get there, it was only when we'd get there.
All things were possible, said Mitt Romney, but then there was a kind of mocking tone towards some of President Obama's perhaps biggest ambitions.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans and to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
There's one for the history books. Did you hear that wave of laughter at solving problems that are absolutely pressing for us right now? Jason Ponton is with me in the studio. What are you thinking as you hear Romney's sort of the two sides of his observation there?
Well, I was running through the reasons why we can't solve big problems.
Yeah.
And there you heard my second example. Sometimes our institutions fail. Sometimes our public leaders choose not to go and take seriously a big problem and to draw the support of the government to solve that problem.
Or even frame them, as you say, as problems worth solving.
So
take us on. What else is in our way?
So sometimes problems that had seemed to be technological turn out not to be so. A good example of this is famine. We had once believed that if we could create some kind of improved technology for food production, famine would be eliminated. But mm-hmm. we did that in the Green Revolution.
Right.
And we've gradually learned that famines are political crises. And to some degree, you will probably never eliminate famines altogether, because there will always be bad governments. There will always be people who choose to make bad decisions mm-hmm. in bad parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Some things just don't lend themselves to technological fixes or breakthroughs ultimately.
And that's sometimes a hard decision to make, but some things are beyond our ability to fix.
And one more piece of this.
Yeah, and the final reason we believe that people can't solve big problems these days is that sometimes we just don't really understand the problem. Big problems are hard, it turns out. I talked about cancer. When Nixon declared war on cancer, we believed that it was a single disease, essentially. And over the last 40 years, we have learned that the cellular catastrophe of cancer has many different mutations. And it's only been since the genomics revolution where we've sequenced the human genome and begun to sequence individual cancer mutations and how they express themselves in individual patients that we've begun to be able to really understand the gene expression of cancer.
So to be fair, and you point this out, going to the moon, as huge a project as that was, in some ways it was simple, you write. I mean, we knew the basics of it. It was not mysterious to us.
So looking at the moonshot is actually quite illustrative in this effect. So the moonshot had all the things that I said you have to have. The public and political leaders must care to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Our institutions must solve its solution. It must really be a technological problem, and we must understand the problem. But having said all that, the moon was easy. It was 3 days away. And arguably, Tom, it wasn't even that much of a problem. The problems of the future, the civilizational problems we face, like creating clean energy for the 9 billion people who will be alive on the planet in 2050, those problems will be harder won.
All the more reason to get our act together and go and do it. We're going to talk to a couple of technologists working on some of those problems right here, but a couple of callers first. Natalie's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Natalie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I am a neuroscientist here at Vanderbilt University.
Great.
And we have world-class scientists here. I have a friend who does cancer research in the infectious disease department, and she got a near-perfect score on her grant, but she doesn't know if that life-saving work will be funded due to our politicians. I think we are not facing here a lack of brilliant, bright thinkers and scientists.
Yep.
We are facing here is a lack of political willpower, a political fear of science. And this is all across the board. This is in infectious disease research and neuroscience. I've worked in labs that have done Alzheimer's disease, geriatric depression, things which have a real immediate need.
Absolutely.
And, due to either our fear of science or our anti-government sentiments, this research, we are not having a lack of dreamers, a lack of big thinkers. What we're having here is a lack of a government that is willing to invest. Every time you elect a Tea Party small government representative, you are saying, I don't want my medical problems to be solved. I don't want cures.
There's a view right from the front line of research, and I'm very glad for that, Natalie. We've got lots of calls. Thanks so much for that view from Vanderbilt. Let me get one. Thanks. One right here from Stowe, Vermont. Jean, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Jason. Thanks for this show. This is these questions I do ponder every day of my life. Although I'm a college dropout, I was a science major. And I've been studying for the last couple of years the 20th century scientists. Right now I'm reading the Oppenheimer biography simultaneous with a book on the history of fluoride and its use during the atom bomb years.
So Oppenheimer, the Manhattan Project, that was big science, that's for sure.
Exactly. And during the early 20th century, America was googly-eyed. All the American scientists, of which Oppenheimer was, although,
sure,
of German descent,
yep,
they were all googly-eyed over the German physicists. And we reached out to not only Germany in the early part of the 20th century, but the UK was way ahead on radar from,
sure,
the U.S. at the beginning of the war. So there we go. We had all this global input to stimulate the creativity of the American scientists. I think it's been sterile, and I'm glad you played a little clip from Eisenhower. If you hear in his closing speech, he warns the military-industrial complex. The last caller hit the nail on the head. But, tell the last caller, I would like to mention to her that it's a very complex subject. Once you get into Washington policy and its overlay of the scientists that influence that policy and then the military's control of things it knew nothing about, which was the science.
Fair enough, Gene. Fair enough. But on the other hand, the military was all over the Manhattan Project. They were all over the moonshot, for that matter. It may be complex in Washington, but that's no reason for citizens not to have sort of bracing views of what's going on. Natalie, Gene, thanks to both of you for those calls. Let me get a couple of people in here who are right on the front lines and doing this. They're both in the big issue of technology review that Jason Ponton has just put together.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing, and I pray.
'cause I am here for reasons.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
Now for something completely different.